host. So, thank you very much for coming to Screen Tone Club Live. This is a live version of our wee little podcast about ye old manga, that lovely thing that we spend too much money on. My name is Elliot Page, professional do-nothing, and I am joined by, as always, by my lovely co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How are you doing, Andy?
Yeah, I was going to say I'm feeling blue, but I think that's just the lighting, so actually I'm doing fine.
Yeah, we're completely surrounded in blue tablecloth, blue lighting, and yeah, this is kind of spooky. We've been upgraded in room from last year. We did this last year at HibanaCon 2018. And now we're back. They somehow didn't kick us out, which is their loss, quite frankly, really.
Yeah, they had their opportunity, but now here we are.
Yeah, we even gave them a ripcord and everything. But hey, so this is, a live version of our wee little manga podcast, Who the Heck Are We? Let's see if the slides work. Slides working out okay? Yeah? Yeah, nodding. Okay, so my name's Elliot Page, as mentioned, professional do-nothing. Also supposedly run a manga search engine at mangasir.ch, pending update. Mr. Andy Hanley, as mentioned, who in his day job works for Anime Limited, and I have also managed to Shanghai him for this silly thing.
Indeed, yes. Please come by a stand in the dealer's room. Plug, plug.
Yep. So we do a joint manga discussion podcast, mostly because we wanted to do a manga podcast of the kind that we want to listen to ourselves. So we both force ourselves to read both titles we're going to cover in an episode so that we can have a decent informed discussion about it, which seems to work out well, I think.
Yes, indeed. An informed discussion, in air quotes.
Yeah, as much as we can be informed, being a pair of white dudes. But also, it's meant that our manga bills have ratcheted right up, which was going to happen anyway, frankly. As is the law of podcasts, now we have a Patreon, because it's either that or we run really terrible native advertising for shaves and mattresses and food boxes, although most of those are going out of business now. So you don't have to listen to those, or herbal male supplements, which just sounds even skeevier, quite frankly. But at least it gives you something to do on your new mattress you bought because of a podcast. But yeah, we have bonus episodes once a month, which is voted for by our patrons. So there's like a circle of life going on there. If you're interested, we are also near to our next Patreon goal, which will give you two bonus episodes a month, one of which, as always, you can vote on. We've very recently had a bonus episode on Princess Jellyfish, the Akiko Higashimura joint, which was, I feel, really good. I really enjoyed it.
Yes, yeah, indeed. I need to read more of that series now.
I have been reading more of that series, but more to come on that shortly. We have another panel if you want more manga. We have the £100 Manga Library at 4 p.m. today in Event 4, so across the way. Please come along to that, because I spent far too long on the slides when I didn't need to. Mostly because I realised I'm going to have to cut half of them when we skim through it. Anyway, moving on to the most important part of our Patreon is the shout-outs tier to the gentleman in the front row, Rob Jessup, who, as mentioned before, keeps the podcast going and pays for the hosting quite handily. So thanks, Rob. You two can also join Rob and get embarrassed every single fortnight on the episode if you fancy.
I like how it's now at the point where Rob, at this convention, has had people like, oh, you're the guy from the Screen Tone Club podcast.
Yeah, literal thing that's happened to poor Rob. I'm responsible for this, but I don't apologize. So, moving on to the first part of our podcast. This list is kind of long, so we might cut this a wee bit. But it's Returning Champions. This is where we jump back on series that one or both of us have read since we first covered it. I'm more interested in the second item, so I want to hear about Blank Canvas Volume 2, if you don't mind, Andy, because I certainly didn't put that on there.
Yeah. I mean, there's not too much for me to say about it, really. This is very much one of those, it's more of the same if you liked Volume 1. So for people who aren't aware, Blank Canvas is Akiko Higashimura of Princess Jellyfish's fame. It's her autobiographical manga about, you know, her early life, how she kind of, you know, well, how she sort of stumbled into writing manga, basically. And the first volume is very much about her kind of struggles with herself, just because she's kind of full of herself and also kind of lazy at the same time. And a lot of it is about her relationship with a particular art teacher who pretty much almost literally knocks her into shape and kind of gets her to the point where she can actually qualify for, you know, art colleges and so on and so forth. So the first volume kind of ends with a cliffhanger of, you know, will she get into any of the universities she wanted? Spoilers, she does get into one. And volume two is very much about her falling off the wagon pretty hard again. Like she gets to where she needs to be. She starts this art college and then immediately kind of just clams up in terms of her artistic output. And then rather than actually trying to work at kind of getting back on the wagon, she just finds that boys and fashion and just hanging out in coffee shops, etc., are far more interesting, and just kind of completely goes off the rails in that way that I'm sure a fair number of university students can probably kind of recognize as just this, like, oh, I've got all this freedom, so I'm just going to do nothing.
Same.
So that's a big part of it. And then, of course, the ongoing thing is very much what hangs over that entire first volume about, you know, her relationship with this art teacher who's still kind of checking in on her. And it's kind of interesting. The interesting thing about this second volume that really struck me is, Akiko Higashimura is very good at kind of self-deprecation and looking at herself and, you know, what she was doing at that time. I feel like she has a big blind spot for, like, the art teacher that she talks about, because she talks a lot, much like the first volume, about, like, how important he was to, you know, her career and et cetera, et cetera. And there's a lot of kind of, like, foreshadowing, like, oh, if only I'd known how things were going to work out, et cetera,
at the end
et cetera,
of every chapter in which the first volume.
Yeah, which continues, but the weird thing that she never really mentions that I feel like becomes way more clear in the second volume is that the art teacher is kind of living his life vicariously through her at this point. Like, there's a whole bit where he comes and visits her at her university, and he's kind of all geared up to, like, hang out with her art friends and talk about art and, like, you know, check out this college. And it's clearly like him kind of trying to live the life that he never had. And she kind of shuts him down for completely different reasons, because she's just, like, too busy worrying about other stuff. But she kind of, it feels like she has this blind spot of, like, actually, this was kind of a weird relationship from both sides. Whereas she paints it as very much like, oh, you know, he was this great guy who I kind of did wrong by in all of these ways, and kind of misses the other side of it, where maybe things weren't quite as rosy on the other side of that fence either.
Yeah, I mean, you see that in the first volume, where you get to see, like, the weird hodgepodge of him being very, very principled and intense and also selfless, like when he gives her that piggyback ride to the bus stop, even though she had lied, which almost feels like a double abuse situation, where he knows she's lied and so is, like, laying it on thick to, you know, sort of work her out. And then also, as you say, in the first volume, when she tells the teacher which art colleges she's applied to, he goes, oh, you should have aimed higher. And now finding out that he wants to come visit and hang out, that makes it even wilder of, like, so you wanted an in, maybe?
Yeah.
And again, it's very much a case of, it's very much a case of, like, being a reader to someone's lived experience, which is also then fictionalized, kind of, and, you know, 2020 hindsight, etc. So it's an entire melange of unreliability is completely strewn throughout it. But at the same time, like, yeah, the art teacher is a very strange character who you'd almost like to see them draw the manga.
Yeah. I mean, you'd love to kind of hear their side of the story. But it's still a very entertaining series. Like, I'm a sucker for kind of interesting autobiographies, and, like, the author has had an interesting life and interesting youth and is very good at telling that story. Like, again, I very much appreciate, like, the self-deprecating humor and her ability to kind of look at herself and be like, yeah, I was kind of a mess, and, you know, I'm quite willing to, like, throw all that onto the page. So it's very entertaining. Like, if you've read stuff like Princess Jellyfish and Tokyo Terror Ebba Girls and kind of want to see more about the person behind that and kind of how they got their start, kind of almost in spite of themselves, like, it's very entertaining, it's good fun, it's kind of informative in terms of how all that stuff works out. So yeah, like, I'm definitely still on board to keep on reading it, even though it does continue to hammer on this, oh, my poor art teacher, if only I knew, without ever, like, at some point the penny's going to drop and we're going to see exactly why we're having this kind of maudlin thing at the end of every chapter. And I'm just hoping it's going to be, like, less obvious than it seems, but who knows?
Who knows? I mean, I moaned about this in our previous discussion, but it really winds me up, that sort of recurring comeback to moment. It's like, yes, you've said this every single chapter. Like, I almost wish this wasn't, like, a frequently published thing and was just a one shot so you could get it done with.
Yeah.
Yeah. So on the Akiko Higashimura bent, my laptop fell asleep. As a present? Yeah, okay. Yeah, sorry about that. So Princess Jellyfish, after our premium episode about Volume 1, I kind of broke down and, well, I broke down three separate times because after that, I then went and bought Volume 2 off Comixology in a mild fit of, gotta read more. And that also includes another story from Higashimura's youth in the Omake where she basically fills in the bit right before Blank Canvas. And it's basically like her saying, yes, I was a jellyfish otaku, but then I watched a Barcelona Olympics and started stalking a medium sprint runner which just seemed, and also like I'm glad that Statue of Limitations has expired because some of her stuff she does and she relates in that afterward, if not a lie, is actually criminal, and so highly worrying for her. But it kind of comes encapsulated in that whole self-deprecating sheen that means it takes the edge off, thank goodness. But Princess Jellyfish, as I say, it continues the journey with Tsukimi and her Amar's friends in the weird nunnery retro house as they find out about the possible impending closure. And that's kind of the main driving force behind the series at this point, where it's a slightly hands-off, like there's kind of multiple timelines of actions going on. Like there is the constant threat of, oh snap, the place we live might get sold out from under us. Oh snap, this pretty boy won't leave me the hell alone. Oh snap, his brother is extremely dowdy, but also kind of hot because he's so dowdy. So it kind of goes from there. And each time I would read the omnibus volumes, because it's a two volume chunk, like it's a 360 odd page chunk each volume, and would then break down and buy the next one. And I've only just broken that recently because I'm now at the finish of Volume 4. And on Friday, I basically stood in Waterstones and manga cowed it up for a good 50 pages of Volume 5. So I can't stop myself. Yeah, it's like those little kids who used to read Fullmetal Alchemist all the time. But it's great. Like, I'm really enjoying it. The characters are really fascinating. Like, it kind of plays to the fact that Tsukimi thinks she's a complete and utter wreck, even though she's just doing her best with the situation she's ended in. She has, like, latent trauma in her past. It started introducing some of the side characters and what they can do. But also, more importantly, it isn't just sort of delving into people's dark backstory. It's more also about taking them as they are now and bringing them to the light and sort of letting them have their own talents rather than just, I am the product of X bad accident. Instead, it's like, hey, this person does himself down, but they're actually really skilled. They just apply it in this really nerdy way, which is absolutely fine, and we don't need to worry about it. But also, they're not a complete wreck. So, you know, Maya, the Three Kingdoms nut, has a secret talent that completely blows most of the cast away, including herself, and she is the one person who can't handle it most of all, which is a really lovely part of, like, Volume 4. And so it's continuing. There's now a love polygon in play and lots of misunderstandings that are much more human than your average manga misunderstanding. And as I'm sat here, I'm basically just trying to work out when I'll buy Volume 5. I keep telling myself I'll wait for a proper sale and buy it on discount. But at the same time, it's like, well, it's £6 a volume and it's two volumes worth of manga. So ... it does do the annoying Higashimura thing sometimes of the volumes being like a good quarter are like omake and side stories, which drives me nuts because that's nice. Thank you for the bonus content. But what I want to read the main storyline. Stop that. But yeah, it's a really good ride. It's also really, really pretty. Like, it's kind of wild. Like, I think Higashimura's art assistants must hate her for all the different fashion that's going on and all the different character sort of moments. So it's wild, but it's a really fun read. It really straddles the line between like personal development and putting yourself out there, and also like the latent fear of being a human. I don't know. It's just like it's kind of constant sort of, I can do it, I really can't, which often come almost like two sides of the same coin, especially in Tsukimi, who is a really great character. Yeah, especially for someone who just basically hangs out in a grey, you know, tracksuit the whole time. So yeah, real good stuff. Higashimura continues to rule everything around us. Okay, I think we can maybe squeeze a quick note in on Dead Demons DD Destruction.
Yes, if you don't mind. Is it still good is all I need to know.
Yes, question mark. I mean, Volume 8 is weird. I feel like Volume 8 is a case where the real world caught up with the manga, because it introduces more fully like a Donald Trump analog. And
oh, good.
A lot of very direct discussion on political statements and the current state of like both Japan and America and simmering tension about rearmament and such. So it feels like the real world caught up with the manga in an uncomfortable way that makes the real world kind of horn in on its territory. It also has a lot of talking. Like the first half of the volume is a lot of kind of weird catch up and kind of summary of what's been happening if you were too dense to notice the undertones of the message of what the series is driving at. And then it has some real wild twists at the end, which I'm kind of blown away by, honestly, although not in a possibly good way, because it's a case of, okay, at the end of the volume, it ends on this wild, almost 1-2-3 punch of just, okay, here's a thing, here's what it means, and now we have to think about the consequence of this. And then the volume ends, and I swore, because it's like, well, got to wait for volume 9 to find out how this pans out and if it's any good, which is kind of the problem, because now it's a hanging option whether this can actually be the current plot state can be handled well. Because it could, you know, I trust Inio Asano from the previous 8-7 volumes, but I don't know, I feel like this is a really powerful inflection point in the series where it has a lot of chickens to come home to roost. Like, they're kind of waiting to get in the coop, but they haven't opened the door yet. Someone asked that I would make a terrible metaphor, and there it is.
If you have mixed metaphors on your bingo card, please cross that off now.
Yeah, it was going to come at some point. But no, so Volume 8 is a real mixed read for me, where I enjoyed it, but at the same time, it's like, I'm really unsure about that. Also, it kind of spends quite a lot of time like making things that were already obvious, like just flat out text of like saying it out loud. And it's like, yes, I knew that. But either way, at this point, I feel like the board is set. And so whether it can execute or not will be the real test from here. So we shall see.
Fair enough. I think I know what I'm downloading for my plane ride home tomorrow now.
Oh, yeah. That's how I read it on the plane. And I was just like, you know. We have one more item on Returning Champions, but we're going to skip that for now for doing our main part of the show. So, main part of the show, first title we looked at was my pick off Manga Plus, the new Kodansha-sponsored online digital free reader thing, which is a bit confusing sometimes. Has added more historical titles on it now, but it is the title "'Tis Time for Torture, Princess." The image got a bit cut off, but basically it's written by Robinson Haruhara and it's illustrated by Hirake. It is currently weekly, it's 28 chapters, it's digital only on web or on Android and iOS app. It's completely free to read, the entire run of it is available, and it's basically about the titular princess who doesn't have a name, so I don't have a name to forget for once, which is really great. You can see she's a princess because she's got a tiny wee crown that somehow magically stays on her head despite everything that happens. And she is joined by the magical holy sword, X, who shares a cell with her and they just hang out. But he is your narrator. He is your speed wagon, except in a sword, as a sword. And basically, the lady with horns who's cut off by the image is Torcha Tortura, good name, who is a high inquisitor in the Demon Lord's army. And the Demon Lord wants some secrets from this captured princess because both a princess, she is also a general of the human army. And she has been raised from birth to blah, 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 destroy the demons, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, she's basically had a really sheltered upbringing and just wants to be a normal girl. And so instead of torturing her with like awful things like, you know, prodding her and using branding irons, they use much more mundane things to then get much more mundane secrets out of her. And so it becomes a gag of the week show, where every week they torture her or just tempt her with something new and alluring that is quite nice and pleasant. And she then usually gives up the ghost after about 3 pages of going, well, I defeated blah, blah, blah. And you get this whole flashback with loads of dead orcs and stuff. And then no, she gives up the ghost at the end. Anyway, so the first chapter is about toast and how good toast is. And why you would immediately give up if you're interrogated with toast. And you can kind of see in the image here, I'll explain it for the listeners, it's kind of some of the reasons why I like this show, but also really dislike it, is the fact that it has this leery eye on the princess, especially in the first few chapters. It kind of knocks it off after a while. But you can see in the image, she's got the whole slave garments falling down, revealing ever so slightly a little bit of a titty. And of course she's in chains because she's a captured princess. And that's kind of one of the things that I dislike about the series, especially, as I say at the start, is where you get the whole like food wars style, exploded away cloves in an alternate universe because the toast tastes so good sort of thing.
And there's a weird kind of, it really ramps that up for a little while in the series as well. There are a bunch of chapters where every chapter feels a little bit more horny than the last, and you feel like the author's going on a trajectory, and then suddenly it just kind of stops. It's as if they just kind of get over it, or at least it kind of rolls it right back.
Yeah, which I frankly appreciate, because just as I was about to get really sick of the series, and even never bothered initially recommending it for this, was they stopped it. Like, they're still, they still have a hot, they even later on have an onsen episode, which is extremely chaste, and the steam is very agreeable with covering bits up. But it's also more about just, isn't a bath nice with friends, which is one of the things the princess has been denied all her life. But yeah, I'm with you. Like, there's a screenshot I meant to take for this, but here's an example of, like, this is when she's eating, she's talking about, what's the face? Takoyaki being intoxicating, which is a good pun.
It is a very good pun.
But also, this is her, like, after having done the whole, like, heart symbol on abdomen sort of picture, which I'm pretty sure is used in a lot of hentai. So it's pretty, it gets pretty rough with the, like, princess, like, explosions, as it were, which, as I said, like, nearly put me right off the series. And then thankfully it knocks it off. And it becomes a lot more just fun. I kind of enjoyed it. Long story short is that it kind of falls into a nice pattern of, it gets a bit more communal and a bit more fun rather than just like poking fun at the princess and the idiot sword just kind of going off on one. It does start to slowly sort of become more of a communal sort of pleasant thing where you get introduced to more members of the Hell Army, including the Beastmaster, who has a polar bear cub, and the like pair of twins who are basically just a pair of dorks who play Smash Brothers, and then the Hell Lord's daughter, who is really adorable. And there's even a chapter later where she dares to ask her papa for a piggyback ride. And if anything, the Hell Army are way more fun in the series. I don't know where you came down on it, Andy, but that's kind of how I ended up, is like kind of enjoying the goofiness of it all.
Yeah, I did end up enjoying it. Like, this was one of those ones where, again, being on Manga Plus, like, it was, we kind of left this open, like, read as much of it as you need to, and there was a point where it was going through its kind of like making everything sexy phase where I thought, like, you know, I've probably read enough now, I could stop. And then once it rolled that back, I kind of found myself quite readily sort of, you know, just churning through the rest of it, because I was worried that it was just going to fall into the pattern of every chapter was going to be, here's some delicious looking food, here's the torture, quote unquote, and that was going to be it. But it actually varies things up quite nicely. Like you say, it has the whole hot springs thing, there's, like, you know, visit to a theme park, playing video games. Like, it has kind of a very obvious cadence, like, you know what's going to happen every chapter, but it manages to mix things up enough that it sort of, it manages to stop being overly repetitive, especially once it starts to introduce other characters and, you know, you get to spend a bit of time with the actual demon lord, etc., etc. So yeah, I ended up enjoying it. It's kind of smart in a way how it takes kind of perhaps one of the worst excesses of sort of fantasy and kind of isekai series of the whole kind of like female character being tortured and incarcerated, etc., etc., and somehow manages to turn it into something mostly kind of wholesome and fun and friendly. And it's sort of, I quite like how it ends up subverting that whole trope and just turning it into a just like, yeah, and then everyone became friends because they're all nice people at the end of the day. And there was something quite enjoyable about that come the end of it.
Yeah, totally. I mean, you know, there's one chapter in the middle of the run of the 28 we get to where basically they go to a theme park and it's like, oh, that's cool, I've never been to a theme park because I'm a princess, blah 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 blah. And then they notice that one of the other side characters isn't present. It's like, oh, they caught a cold. And it's like, well, never mind that, let's go Western Well then. And it's like, oh, that's a really nice swerve, that's very pleasant, like, oh, they did a really nice thing. It's, you know, it also doesn't overstay that sort of set up either. Like, there's obviously clearly like an undercurrent of like, maybe the human world is at fault here, but it never actually directly smacks on that, which is probably for the best, because then it'd have to actually grow a plot and then become very boring, most likely, or become dramatic, which is usually the death of comedy series, especially if they make it into an anime and then they're like, oh, episode 12, time for the serious plot line. So as I say, it's really pleasant and very goony, which is kind of the really fun thing about it, especially as you say, when the extended cast come into the fore.
Yeah. And it looks really nice as well. Like, the character designs in particular are all really great. You know, every time there's a new character introduced, they have a really good look to them that kind of fits that character and their role. So I really like that. And the art style as a whole, like, you know, yes, occasionally it's when it drifts into being horny, it is what it is. But, like, generally speaking, it's really nice to look at as well. Like, I feel like that kind of kept me going even when maybe it had a chapter that felt a little bit more repetitive. It's like, I still like the way this all looks.
Yeah, it really, especially whenever it does like food based torture, it really sells you. Rather than it being like extravagant and pornographic, it's like, that looks real tasty, which is probably one of the benefits. Also, because most of it takes place in like an underground dungeon, that's kind of easy to draw because it's brickwork. You show it once and then you don't need to do backgrounds ever again. So that probably saves some effort.
Yeah, for sure. And I think the other thing for me that kind of sells it really easily is the fact that this is on Manga Plus and that it's free. Like, it's kind of much like on previous ventures, you know, talking about streaming anime, like the bar is significantly different when you're not actually having to pay for a volume. You know, I might struggle to recommend it a bit more if you were having to, you know, drop 5-6 quid for a volume, but it's all there and free right now. Like, you know, basically it's just your time commitment of spending an hour or so reading the chapters that are there so far. And, like, you know, it's an easy read as well. So, you know, it's not a big investment of anything. And, like, it's kind of feels like a bargain once you actually factor in that you're not having to pay to read it.
Yeah, I mean, Manga Plus in particular, like, the apps and the website are a little bit janky, but the one benefit is that if you just keep hitting the left key to go to the next page, you'll get to the bit where it has a single advert after a chapter and then skip you right into the next chapter.
Yeah.
So you can flat out just keep whacking a single key on your keyboard and you'll go through the series really handily. Yeah.
Some of those adverts are really bizarre though, but that's a whole other discussion.
I got one for a paternity test. I'm like, wait, what? Hang on, what? Like, what does this mean? Like, it's like, oh, guess what, Elliot? Like, you haven't been manga podcasting. You've got an illegitimate child out there. Like, what? No. Some of the adverts are real wild.
It's a good reveal for a live podcast, to be fair. Illegitimate children, but
yeah, check it out. So it's a good fun read, as you mentioned. Like, it's because it's free, it's very easy to recommend because you can, as I say, with the weird hump of like the horny hump, and then after that, it gets a lot easier to kind of recommend. There's a really good chapter, actually, one I want to call out that I have read like several times because it makes me laugh every time. Is they're trying to torture the princess with cup noodle, because of course you've got to do that. You've got to do cup noodle. And the princess goes, don't worry, I only like the seafood kind. And it's like, oh, okay, thanks for that. Why do you have to tell the enemy that, idiot? But then what they do is they leave it with the water in past the 3-minute mark, and they start squirming and going, no, you're going to ruin it. You're going to ruin it. And it goes from there.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's the nice thing that it does, that again, kind of keeps things just slightly fresher, that it manages to subvert some of its things where you think like, oh yeah, okay, I know the exact cadence of how this chapter is going to go. And then it just twists it ever so slightly that just makes you feel like, oh, okay, this isn't the predictable thing I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And it knows how to keep the gag running, mostly because the Hell Lord is really hard to please with the information he gets. There's also that great panel where he says, oh no, I can't invade on Sunday, there's too many Sunday morning cartoons I want to watch. Yeah. And it's like, oh, one of us. So as a quick mention, we've got intermission so I can drink some tea. So as part of the intermission, here are my cats, Ruby and Sapphire. People can't see this at home. For the audience, I'll put it on the website, but yeah, I'm currently like 300 miles away from them, so I miss them dearly. Anyway, right, good to go.
Yeah.
Okay, so the second half, end of intermission. So the second title is To Your Eternity by Yoshitoki Omiya of Silent Voice fame. This was your pick, Andy, if you want to take it away.
Yes, yeah, indeed. So yeah, I picked this very much just off the strength of like, well, a Silent Voice is good, so you know, what could possibly go wrong here, which always serves people so well in manga criticism terms. So To Your Eternity starts off very simply with an orb, this strange kind of extraterrestrial orb, basically, that lands on the planet and can replicate any form that it likes. It can basically absorb and become that form, at least in terms of its kind of physical being. Kind of mentally is a bit of a different story. So kind of the early going of the series it kind of goes through a few phases before it effectively becomes a wolf that it finds that's kind of died in this kind of snowy tundra. Ends up sort of becoming a companion of this boy called Joan, who's kind of been left behind by his clan or his tribe or whatever in this frozen wasteland. The boy in question, kind of after just hanging around, living his life for a while, just kind of in isolation, decides that he should set out for the paradise that his kind of cohorts had set out to discover in the past. So he goes on this journey through, you know, the snow and these wastelands. That doesn't go so well. The journey ends up being abandoned. He returns back to his home. He returns back injured and ends up dying. So, of course, the orb then absorbs him. And in the meantime, there's this whole other kind of plot line that basically intermingles with this about this young girl called March who lives in a village. She's been selected as a human sacrifice for some kind of ritual in this village, which, you know, clearly she's not so keen on, as you can imagine. And so kind of the two characters, this kind of orb in human form and March, kind of end up sort of coming together in the midst of March sort of trying to escape her fate. And they sort of fall in together really by the end of this volume. But there's still a lot left kind of unsaid and a lot left to do. This is very much a first volume that is a lot of setup and not really any payoff particularly, which kind of makes it a bit difficult to talk about. And it also, from my point of view, makes it difficult to recommend at this point. Like I've been trying to kind of get to grips with how I feel about it. Cause like, I feel like the core conceit is kind of interesting, like obviously, especially from the author of A Silent Voice, like, you know, a series that is purporting to talk a lot about kind of, you know, life and death and, you know, the interrelationship between the two and the way that is set up, you know, has a lot of potential. But I guess this almost feels like I'm kind of watching a building being put up and you're kind of watching them put down the foundations. And it just looks like it's slightly off, like it kind of feels like it's not quite being built right. And it feels like every layer that gets stacked up, it's just kind of veering off to one side a little bit more. Because there's just, I don't know, it always feels like a kind of discrepancy between what the series is trying to do and what it actually achieves. And I think it's partly like, the whole orb idea of just like, oh, this can absorb things and take on its properties and like it doesn't understand life or death or care about it. Like it can, if it's sort of the host that it is kind of, you know, become, like dies, it can just regenerate itself and come back to life and heal itself. So it has no interest in kind of mortality. But like, there's something about that it's so cold and clinical that it's just, it doesn't really hold any weight or have any real interest. Yeah. And then on the other side of the coin, you know, you have March and the whole human side where, you know, they're trying to sacrifice her. And, you know, she's made the very conscious and clear decision that, you know, regardless of what she's been told about how important her death is, like she wants to live, she wants to do things. And like, that should be such a good juxtaposition, but neither of those kind of elements come across in a particularly strong way. Like the death side of it is very clinical and kind of March's life side of it is very kind of by the numbers and rote. Like it's not really saying anything interesting and new. And I think that was what I came away from this series from, of like, these are interesting concepts to talk about, but it feels like there's nothing fresh or kind of original that's being said about any of them. And I kind of found that a bit frustrating by the end of it.
Yeah, I'd like to echo. I mean, I totally agree with you, but also I think I took a much dimmer view of it on the whole afterwards. I've kind of skirted around this series for a long time. I've had it recommended to me several times, but there's something clinical and cold about it, which puts me right off, especially because it's like a series about humanity. Like it's clearly going to be a journey for the orb and a series of vignettes and like touching on the elements of humanity. And I suppose also like a discovery of what humanity means and, you know, the impermanence and permanence of memory and feeling. But it's also, as you say, completely clinical and weirdly lensed, where it's about humanity, man, but it feels extremely inhumane, which is the part that drives me nuts, because it's all about humanity, but it doesn't feel humane in any way because of the orb structure. But then again, like with the snowboy main character who you get for the first half, like basically the orb in wolf form just stands by completely and utterly impassively, which, you know, is explained as being its lot because it doesn't know how to interact. But then once the boy dies, it then, you know, cannibalizes and takes his form, leaving his corpse. So he hasn't inherited anything from the boy apart from his physical shape. And even then it says, oh, he did not know that the orb did not know it needed to eat. And it's like, you spent like 6+ months watching this dude need to eat and then dying partially malnutritioned. Like, that's weird. Mm. Like, you'd think you'd know that, but that's the kind of, there's like a conflict there where it wants to be about this orb and see the picture of humanity. And, you know, there's clearly a hope, an aim to show the goodness of humanity through its strife and struggles. But at the same time, it feels extremely exploitative, like with the, you know, the human sacrifice thing and March vacillating and going back and forth on whether she wants to, because it's a threat hangover March where basically it's like, hey, if you don't die, your little sister might have to. What do you think about that? And then it'll be on your head. And it's like, okay, Christ, like, okay, well, March is going to try and do the adult thing. Like, she does a flirt with escaping and then makes her mind up to try and be the sacrifice. And then they kind of almost resolve the root cause perhaps behind it, which, you know, which feels very charmed. And as a result, but the whole thing with the juxtaposition just feels like a tale of humanity told from an extremely inhumane perspective in a way that it's not alien, but just cruel, which is what put me off about the series and why I'm probably not going to keep continuing with it, because it's left me such a bad taste in my mouth about wanting to kind of dig through any more of it, because I kind of, at this point, don't trust the series to, like, be fair, almost, if that makes sense. Like, I feel like it's being very exploitative to kind of, like, you know, get, like, wind the tear ducts up on the reader.
Yeah, so. But yeah, I mean, I think that's the weird thing is that it never really succeeds in doing that, because, I mean, again, like the whole thing with, you know, the boy and the wolf, you know, it's a pretty big chunk of this first volume is, you know, his journey failing, him having to go back. And again, it's all told in such a kind of dispassionate way that it didn't really particularly move me. And it's, again, like you say, it's strange because, you know, the orb learns nothing from any of this, really. It kind of, you know, as soon as it absorbs the boy, it just reverts to type and, you know, forgets that it needs to eat, et cetera, et cetera. Because I was, again, it would have been a bit cliched for it to learn about love from this relation, you know, from hanging around with this boy. And that wasn't necessarily what I wanted it to do, but come the end of that sort of arc of the story, it felt like nothing had been kind of gained particularly. Like, you know, we'd, if anything, the only character we'd sort of engaged with at all as the reader is this boy who then, you know, dies pretty soon after. And so it kind of felt like it didn't really show me anything that I needed to see at that point. It felt very sort of, you know, by the numbers, and that there wasn't any particular need or meaning to any of that.
Yeah, especially because it lays the despair on so thick, like with the snow boy, basically. I forget his name again. Rohan?
Johan.
But yeah, it lays it on so goddamn thick. And like, I'm not expecting it to be like, oh, look, I found the promised land. It's like, no, it would just be nice if you didn't have to, like, just crap on this character continuously and then have him be pseudo-zombied. But, yeah, that's why, I mean, it's, like, so aggressively, like, inhumane about how it handles humanity as a concept, as a, like, a prime character for it to examine. Mm. And, yeah, and also, frankly, like, and all that aside, it's just the fact that I just didn't find it enjoyable to read. Like, it, you know, it's, well, so as a quick side note, it's extremely pretty. Like, it's really pretty. Like, you get snowy tundra, you get wonderful inside shots of this crazy, like, long boat on its side. You get really nice pictures of jungle when it comes to March's tale. The characters all look lovely. They look a bit samey, some of them, but they are background characters, and it looks very sort of, you know, this author's background character style, where everyone looks a bit Shoko-ish. But it looks marvelous. Like, and you get this giant monster bear thing and these antagonists who are themselves just humans with silly haircuts because that's what their religion demands. And it looks marvelous, but that then makes it, I don't know, for me, it makes it more glaring that I just can't get on with the series, even though I look at it and go, man, this is real effing pretty. Like, there's a lot of real clear passion and drafts work, and you know, it all feels whole, which is again another reason why what's projected on it for me just doesn't really work, and I didn't find myself enjoying it. Like, again, halfway through this volume I was going, ah, crap, like I'm gonna have to complain about this series and I'm pretty sure that some people are gonna moan at me because I didn't like it, because it's held in such high regard by people I trust, so whoops, sorry.
Yeah, well, I mean, I feel like even the art style is kind of suffers from the same issue, because yeah, like my notes was that, you know, it's very detailed but it felt proficient rather than kind of anything above and beyond that. I didn't kind of get any real kind of sense of emotion or kind of anything kind of beyond just like, you know, again, it's that clinical, like, here is how things look, and there's not really any kind of life to it. It sort of almost felt a little bit lifeless to me, you know. Even, I mean, March's side of things maybe have a bit more kind of, you know, going for them in terms of, you know, character design and you know, how things look and sort of move within and between panels.
Well, there's a lot of interesting sort of ideas behind that, because it's a completely different and an alive civilization, and they have like a whole heap of different elements to them where it's like, oh, children wear ink on their faces, and you're like, oh, that's interesting, why is that? Don't know, we ain't got time for that.
There is a lot of that throughout the volume as well. There are a lot of things where it's like, I'd actually be interested to dig in more to just like the world's state as a whole, because there's clearly a lot of things that have happened in the varied kind of elements of this world, and a lot of that understandably kind of get left on the sideline because it's not what the story is about, but yeah, they were almost felt like some of the more interesting bits of just like, I'd actually like to see this branch out and get a bigger picture.
Yeah, even with like Johann Snowboy, like, you know, the quiet moments are really pleasant because it's very intricately drawn of like him making a stew, you know, and that sort of thing, and like the struggles to survive in this weird, like, sort of snowed out wonderland. Like, that, again, it's kind of interspersed with parts that I enjoyed, but as a whole, I didn't find it good, like, enjoyable to read as a result, which is, yeah. And also, like, as you said, Andy, like, it all feels like Foundation. Like, the end of this volume ends on kind of like a combination of new state for the characters, that now you have a small posse going, and also you get like a breakthrough moment on the last page, which is extremely creepy, creepily drawn, but it's like a moment of breakthrough in terms of the characters of like, oh, okay, this presages something more interesting, except in a really creepy, like, you know, spit-flecked way. Yeah, but we'll see. I mean, so it's available digitally and physically. You can also read it on Crunchyroll Manga if you can get the reader to work, or the app to work, given it's still Flash-based and Chrome will yell at you if you try and use it. But it is available to read on there. So if you are interested, maybe jump on Crunchyroll Manga to give it a read to see how you feel about it. That'll probably be a really good way to start, also for no money. If you have a Crunchyroll subscription, big asterisk on there.
Yeah, that maybe is the way to do it, because, yeah, I mean, I just bought the first volume digitally. But, yeah, like, it is a weird thing, because there is part of me, like so many series we talk about on here, where I'm at least curious to see where it goes next, because, like, the end of this first volume does set up so much for where it might go next. But by the same token, it doesn't do anything that makes me kind of trust in it having an interesting direction, because if it continues to be as detached as it is currently, then that's a big ask in terms of, you know, finding anything to invest my time in.
Yeah, and I feel part of it, like you say, is like coming into it expecting, like, with a lot of good faith from A Silent Voice, which kind of, like, you know, it kind of came down the other side of the fence where it put me through the ringer, but I trusted it, like, to say something, to be the better half of the equation, whereas this comes down on the other half of like, man, I kind of don't like how you're squeezing my soul here.
So. Yeah, well, yeah, I think that's the weird thing for me, because A Silent Voice, you know, deals with very difficult subject matter and does it in a very direct and honest way, but it is also an incredibly human story. Whereas this, you know, again, it's dealing with difficult subject matter, but it's not really doing it in any way that is kind of particularly relatable or particularly deep. Like, no. You know, this first volume in particular is very, you know, I feel like it said nothing that made me sit up and think like, oh, yeah, you know, I'm going to consider this. This is going to kind of, you know, be something to think about in the shower, or, you know, keep me up at night or anything like that. Whereas, I mean, A Silent Voice, you know, you can spend a long time kind of, you know, digging into everything that happens in that series and, you know, what it represents and what you can learn from it, etc., etc. Whereas this, it was just like, yeah, it, death is death, life is life.
Except when it's not, and you're an orb.
And then, yeah, you know, clearly there is a lot to consider there, but there's nothing that hasn't been said many, many times before.
Yeah. So, I mean, also, like, I mean, even just from, like, a really, like, base level sort of appreciation, like, you know, going onto the Kodansha Comics website and seeing all the future covers are like, oh, I wonder what all this is. Like, which is kind of this weird, annoying thing of, like, all these covers look really cool. Are these going to be more characters who I feel bad for by the end because they've been shat on by the plot, question mark? Like,
yeah. I mean, the covers for later volumes look incredibly different to, like, the world state and worldview of the first volume.
Well, even the first two, like, characters you meet are in completely different worlds, and I almost want to ask, like, wait, what happened in the Integrum here? Like,
yeah,
how far did, like, Orb Snowboy walk? So
so
bit of a mixed feeling. I'm probably not gonna bother continuing.
No, I don't think I'll, you know, it's one of those things, if I had infinite time and infinite money, I would probably check out at least volume two out of curiosity, but I have neither of those things, so I will probably not.
I mean, see, even as I'm talking about it and as I've just sort of ragged on it, I'm now that I'm remembering it's on Crunchyroll Manga, it's like, maybe I'll just check volume two out just to do. But we'll see. I don't know. Again, infinite time, infinite money. Hell, as a complete side note, I like found out how many unread volumes I have, and I have like 60 unread volumes of manga on like between different services, so I should probably actually read some of that first. Anyway, moving, so that's To Your Eternity. And moving on to what we're covering next episode. So we've got a physical only double bill because we're evil and hate ourselves and want to fill our houses up. So first and foremost, I have picked the Naoki Urasawa work Master Keaton, which is one of his older works before he kind of blew up with Monster and so on. It's about a insurance adjuster who goes around and basically MacGyvers his way around finding out the truth behind various spurious insurance claims. I think he's also partially an archaeologist. He's kind of like an archaeologist, sociologist, soft sciences, wunderkind with a funny nose and a pseudo-estranged family. But yeah, it got recently a nice, shiny re-release from Viz, physical only, because Urasawa can do one. And yeah, it's now available with nice gold foil on the cover. I got mine from Edinburgh Forbidden Planet as part of a 3-for-2. So it wasn't quite as painful. But it is a very nice volume, lovely big paper size. We'll see how that does. But yeah, volume one of that. And Andy, your pick?
Yeah, so my pick was partly just retaliatory because you picked a physical manga. And
you picked
so
this one first.
You picked first. So I saw that and thought, right, well, it's on then, I guess. This also gave me an excuse to finally pick up a series that I've wanted to read in manga form for a long time, and that is Hiromu Arakawa, the Fullmetal Alchemist author's A Silver Spoon, which is not very much like Fullmetal Alchemist at all because it's about farming and an agricultural college. But I've watched the anime and it's terrific, so I've been keen to actually check out the source material, even though I'm kind of terrified because there's quite a lot of it. Although it's about to finish in Japan, so that might actually be a good excuse just to burn through the thing and finish it all.
I think recently there was like an announcement there are like 4 chapters left.
There is.
So yeah, we'll see. I mean, it is quite long and, as mentioned, physical only, and kind of comes out in diminutive volumes because of the publisher.
But this is also very much like I got to recently rewatched the second season of the anime, which kind of leaves things at a point of like, man, I really want to spend more time with these characters and see what happens to them, and there's only one way to do that, so I guess maybe I can get on this train and see where it goes.
Yeah, Silver Spoon has definitely been one of those series that I've wanted to read because absolutely love the anime, like shed tears over it when I watched it, and now it's like I want to read the manga, but I don't want to buy physical books because I ain't got space and I'm sick of lugging manga around whenever I move house. And now it's just a case of, well, fuck it. So here we go. How many, off the top of your head, do you remember how many volumes it is?
I think the 10th volume is out in English currently.
Yeah.
I don't know how far behind the Japanese releases they are, so I'm guessing it's going to be like 12, 13 volumes or so.
Okay, that's more reasonable. If it started to get to like 26, I'd have to start getting another Billy bookcase or something,
It's not that crazy. They haven't had any like tournament battles or anything, so it's nice and short, in inverted commas.
Friggin' pig raising tournament battle. Great. So Silver Spoon and Master Keaton, looking forward to those. And also, as a note, if you are a patron, you can vote on what we're going to cover in our next bonus episode. Voting ends in about a week from now, so we have time to read it. Currently a two-way dead heat. We'll see what comes out on top. We have some nice new lovely light novels in our future, as it turns out.
So. Oh, good.
This one might be good. Hey, it's not isekai, so whatever. Close down. Thank you very much for coming to this panel. I know it's a Sunday mid-morning after an anime con. You can find our previous episodes and much more at screentone.club. You can also join the Patreon, as mentioned, vote for series to cover. And we have another panel later on today at 4 p.m. You can see myself, Andy, and wonderful guest Laura, who is in the front row and waving hi, which will be in panel four. That's an old slide, so I'm going to ignore that. So that'll be in panel four at 4 p.m. to talk about £100 manga library, where you can find out how to make a really damn good, respectable library of manga for 100 bones, which is mostly an excuse for us to flex on stuff we like. So indeed. There we are. Yep. Cool. So, as again, thank you everyone for coming. Check out the website, screentone.club. We'll also hopefully record the £100 manga panel, so we can then put it up on the feed or just shove it out there on the internet, as you do. So, again, thank you everyone for coming.
Yeah, thanks very much.
Thank you.